Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here with Ann Beatty on the occasion of the publication of the big book, The New Yorker Stories. It is the collection of the 48 stories that appeared in The New Yorker between 1974 and 2006. It is said that Ann Beatty had more stories in The New Yorker than any other writer during any 10-year period. And when these stories began to appear, I began to look forward to their appearance. I couldn't get enough of them, and The New Yorker was very generous. Anne was publishing stories sometimes every month in The New Yorker, and it was so exciting. It was such a fresh new voice. I'm going to ask all the questions that no one ever has asked you.
Uh-oh.
How long had you been sending stories to The New Yorker before they started to accept them?
I was very prolific then. I think it was really about a two-year period, if I remember anywhere near correctly. And I always thought it was 22 rejections. But when Ben Yagoda was researching his very wonderful book about The New Yorker, he did his homework, and apparently it was only 17.
17 rejections. And then tell me the story of the day that the first one got accepted. What were you doing?
Everything disappears from that day except for reading the letter from Roger Angel saying, yes, yes, yes. I couldn't believe I was really seeing those words. And I called him after that, and he was just as full of joy as when he wrote the letter. So he was very happy himself that something finally worked.
Now, is the procedure that they say that first you get slush piled and you get a form letter and then you get a letter more specific or try again or hope to see more of these?
You know, then and now I hear all these things. It's almost like somebody telling you about, some secret ritual or something like that. And it sounds very fetishistic and it sounds very, very weird of what's going on behind the scenes. I don't know what they do now. I personally never got a rejection slip from them. I got a very brief letter from Roger Angel. They did pull me out of the slush pile. Fran Kiernan was reading fiction in those days at The New Yorker, and she apparently pulled me and gave the story to Roger, and he did write me directly saying, we have interest, and please address these stories to me in the future.
And tell me, who at that time was reading your fiction?
Friends. I was in graduate school at the University of Connecticut, and I think I was just teaching freshman comp and buying myself time to write. So my ex-husband, David Gates, is one of the people that was reading them, and several good friends, and some of them still reading my fiction.
I got so excited. I think, you know, during the first year, the first three or four stories, as I now have occasion to read them, and they're so different from one another. Each time you're there, it's a different voice, different kinds of characters, different shape of story. I mean, it was so exciting. Were your friends telling you how good you were? I mean, was this a foregone conclusion?
I guess in a way they were telling me how good I was by wanting to read the material and by laughing in the right places. You know, I did have my ideal audience, people who understood my sense of humor, who got the tone. I was lucky that I had that early on because I never formally studied creative writing.
Yeah, that's what I thought, that you had never been in a writer's workshop.
No.
Were there writer's workshops? What was it like?
No, I don't think there were any workshops at all. There were some so-called creative dissertations. In other words, people turned in a novel and did get a PhD in literature from the University of Connecticut at about the time I was studying there. It never occurred to me to do that. I never even got that close.
Now, had you always meaning from teenager to been writing stories?
A little bit. It didn't seem to me that it was clear that I was going to spend my life in writing, let's put it that way. Yeah, I wrote more of them when I got to graduate school, and I was not a good graduate student. I was very frustrated. They were equally frustrated with me. I hated to, do arguments with criticism that already existed about text. That wasn't my interest in reading, and it certainly didn't humanize what I was asked to read. So I started doing it a bit more than I had in undergraduate school. In undergraduate school, I'd done a mixture of personal essays, which were starting to be, the genre of the time, even a bit of poetry, I cringe to think.
Now, you still read poetry, though.
I do still read poetry, yes.
And I think that these stories are informed by the sensibility of someone who reads poetry.
Well, they certainly are heavy on visual images. I don't mean to generalize about all poetry, but I don't know, the conflation of the visual with the auditory, maybe, something like that.
And yeah. Shifts of tone.
Shifts of tone,
that
right.
are sudden. They always, at least in the early ones, they start out very funny, but they emit messages from time to time that tell you, the reader, that life doesn't make sense, or that life is unreal, or that life is pointless. They come up in the strangest places, these messages, but they're signal posts of a change in tone. And then the stories get sad, and then briefly, ridiculous, and then funny again. But the beauty is that they build by accretion into a kind of melancholy that's really singular and that I think of maybe Salinger having within his grasp, at the end of certain stories where from the beginning the character is going to commit suicide, and then this array of really marvelous novelty details occur and you say, suicide? How can we be heading here? And then you are. Mm-hmm. You are there in a kind of space where sadness pools. Now tell me, the very first published story, what was it about?
A platonic relationship, you mean?
Yeah.
The first New Yorker story that was published. Well, I think it was about what a lot of stories were about in those days, a broken relationship, somebody having an alliance with an unlikely person that they have a sort of quasi-romance with, but that doesn't work out, and then a resumption of something not quite even as acceptable as the status quo.
And right after acceptance, how long did it take before it was published?
I think it happened relatively quickly. I mean, my guess would be maybe about a month, maybe 6 weeks, something like that.
And what was the editing like?
I don't remember the very first few stories because after that, I ended up taking the train to New York and actually sitting at Roger Angel's side while he edited these stories, which was a fantastic experience and taught me more than any writing course I think possibly could have. I think that it was all just, typewritten questions and galleys that came in those days, looking at both Mr. Sean's comments on the galleys and also Roger Angel's, and sometimes they were talking to each other in the margin. I got galleys in those days.
I'm talking to Ann Beattie. All the 48 of the stories that appeared in The New Yorker over the years have been gathered in one book called The New Yorker Stories. What did they know? What did Roger Angel know about editing that other people don't know? What was there for you to learn?
Oh, there was a lot there for me to learn. I still have this problem, and I think writers generally have the problem that they can hear their own tones and they think they see what's on the page, and sometimes those things are simply not played out. They're just not obvious enough in terms of the writing. And often the simplest thing, the change of a word, the addition of a word, one more sentence, that kind of thing can really make the story happen so much easier on a literal level. Also, I think that without saying it directly, there was a little bit of hiding behind technique sometimes and a bit of self-indulgence particularly.
Roger Angel seems to be an editorial figure in the lives of some of my favorite writers, And I think that sometimes these relationships become fearsome. What effect does the approval of an editor have on a writer?
Well, in fairness to Roger, I have to say that, you know, he bore a lot of the burden maybe of the entire fiction department's feelings some of the time, or even possibly of Mr. Sean's feelings at the time, but he was the messenger. So I was never entirely clear as to how something prevailed there. You know, it seemed that sometimes they would invoke the entire fiction department saying yay or nay, and other times I would never hear that at all. It wasn't even at issue. But I do know that Mr. Sean was the one that signed off on everything. However, it needed to get from the fiction department to Mr. Sean. So there's where I don't know what kind of a gap there was there.
Now, Roger Angel, if I remember correctly, was the adopted son of E.B. White and Catherine White?
Well, no, not really. His father was Ernest Angel, who was married to Catherine, and Catherine subsequently married E.B. White.
He
was the child of Catherine and Mr. Angel.
And so this gives him a long reputation at the New Yorker.
Yeah.
Is he still there?
Yes, I understand he is. I don't know that he's there 5 days a week, but yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And still writes for them, of course, wonderfully.
So at that time, were you entering the New Yorker family?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think so, unless entering the New Yorker family was, don't speak to your brothers and sisters. after the fact, a lot of us have joked about this, even some people who were editors also at the time, that you just went to your prescribed place in the New Yorker. There was no hanging around by the water cooler and, giving the high five as you walked down the corridor. None of that.
It's fascinating to me because, you know, I think as an outsider of you and Deborah Eisenberg, you know, talking together and trading notes and what, you know, knowing everything and perhaps getting to meet Mr. Sean's daughter-in-law, Jamaica Kincaid at that time, but none of that.
No. I don't think it happened at any level. I mean, maybe there was – I can remember going to Christmas parties at Roger Angel's, and there would be personal friends among the staff who were there. But with that exception, I can't think that there was ever any interaction. Of course, we all loved the magazine, and we knew each other's work. It's not a bad analogy to say it was like a family in that we were all proprietary about it. We all really thought it was of great value, and we were very involved in ways that we could be. We would do anything – we'd talk to the advertising people, you know, to promote it if they asked us to. We would do what we could, but we didn't interact with each other.
That's so
interesting. All the kids had separate bedrooms, or at least as far as I know, we did.
Now, the tone of the stories change. There is, for me, an archetypal moment of astonishment that I'll never forget when I heard the voice of the narrator of Wolf Dreams. I thought it was so wild and so funny. And I wondered if you'd let us hear the opening of that story.
Sure. Wolf Dreams. When Cynthia was 17, she married Ewell W.G. Peterson. The initials stood for William Gordon. His family called him William. Her parents called him W.G., letting him know that they thought his initials were pretentious. And Cynthia called him Pete, which is what his army buddies called him. Now she had been divorced from Ewell W.G. Peterson for 9 years, and what he had been called was a neutral thing to remember about him. She didn't hate him. Except for his name, she hardly remembered him. At Christmas, he sent her a card signed Pete, but only for a few years after the divorce, and then they stopped. Her second husband, whom she married when she was 28, was named Lincoln Devine. They were divorced when she was 29 and a half. No Christmas cards. Now she was going to marry Charlie Pinehurst. Her family hated Charlie, or perhaps just the idea of a third marriage, but what she hated was the way Charlie's name got mixed up in her head with Pete's and Lincoln's. Ewell W.G. Peterson, Lincoln Devine, Charlie Pinehurst, she kept thinking, as if she needed to memorize them. In high school, her English teacher had made her memorize poems that made no sense. There was no way you could remember what came next in those poems. She got D's all through high school, and she didn't like the job she got after she graduated, so she was happy to marry Pete when he asked her, even if it did mean leaving her friends and her family to live on an army base. She liked it there. Her parents had told her she would never be satisfied with anything. They were surprised when it turned out that she had no complaints about living on the base. She got to know all the wives, and they had a diet club, and she lost 20 pounds, so that she got down to what she weighed when she started high school. She also worked at the local radio station, recording stories and poems. She never knew why they were recorded, and found that she didn't mind literature if she could just read it and not have to think about it.
I love that. That's Anne Beattie reading from the opening of the third story in the New Yorker, Wolf Dreams. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Anne Beattie about her publication in The New Yorker. I regard Anne Beattie as one of the finest living writers in America, and it's very tickling to me to go this far back to her very beginnings and see where that inimitable sound came from. Now, as I said, the tone in these stories changed. And they went from a kind of extraordinary mania to the other side, to the depressive side. And the stories became, you know, almost heartbreaking in their testament to the difficulty of writing about someone whose heart had broken. And then the stories appeared, the most peculiar stories, because you couldn't understand how someone who seemed, by narrative voice, so unhappy had maintained such productivity. And one began to wonder about a writer. Did writing occur no matter what was on the writer's mind, no matter how unhappy the material? It seemed to me that these stories about marriage were so desolate that one would only want to write one of them a year, and yet there they were, appearing with great regularity. What's the relationship between the ability to write things down and sadness?
There are a lot of things that you don't articulate to yourself in so-called daily life that you can find yourself, much to your surprise, writing about over and over again when you try to, you know, write a story. So the life unlived to some extent, I don't think probably I would have been entirely recognizable from the situation of the characters in some of these stories that you're describing, but I know exactly what you're talking about. You're quite right.
It appears fairly quickly, you know, in a sense, that there's an awareness that there's one arrow in the quiver that is the unhappiness arrow. But before that, the stories kind of merrily acknowledge that life makes no sense, that you can't anticipate one thing. And then the poison arrow will come. And that was often the surprise, that someone this funny had such a sense of desolation and woe.
I don't know what to say to that, Michael. To some extent, you know, I remember also coming up with children The first few stories in the New Yorker didn't really have anything to do with children per se, but then you get into something like Snake Shoes or whatever, and it was sort of the child marginalized and on the sidelines because of, say, the marriage breaking up between the parents or something like that. This almost repository for the sadness of the story, I found a stand-in. It wasn't always the adults themselves. In something like Downhill, where the woman is clearly coming apart at the seams, what to say about that? I mean, that certainly is an inscape, and that's really about an adult, has nothing to do with children. But a lot of the time, it was painful for me to look at things straight on, so I put a bystander there. You could filter it through that consciousness in a way.
And some of them, like a middle-year story, like Desire, they were so wonderful and strange because you felt as if what the story was about wasn't clear until the last three sentences. Mm-hmm. And then, in an eerie way, the story would light up. You'd understand what you'd been reading, but at the same time feel extraordinary dread.
Mm. Well, I must say I had none of these endings planned, not at the beginning and not in a story like Desire either. But I think, you know, when you spend some time with your material, that you can't hide from yourself what the subtext is. And it maybe was a little surprising in that Desire is a relatively short story. Something like The Burning House, I think, is longer in length. And, you know, a certain amount of anxiety would build with the writer, too, because I was also asking myself as I was moving toward the end, what is this story about? I didn't want to just come up with a red herring. I didn't want to just derail the story. That was the point at which I would really have to introspect. I've always been very wary of being able to make something shapely, to make it lyrical, to make it radiate in some way that was a concocted way, you know? And so for me, the stories often had to do two things at the end. They could do that. They could have their moment of being concocted. You sort of bring the threads together. You use language in a particular way. I'm thinking, for example, about the ending to The Burning House, when the subtext of the story finally gets addressed and the wife says to the husband, without knowing what she's stumbling into, what are you going to do after the kid's birthday? Are you staying or going? That was enough of a surprise. I didn't even know that that was an issue per se until I wrote that. The fact that he would then answer her and answer her quite eloquently and explain what she'd done wrong with her whole life. You know, the story ends with his saying to her, I'm looking down on all of this from space. I'm already gone. You know, I was horrified. I was completely horrified. And I remember even looking at that and thinking, is that even that too neatly wrapped up? I mean, you know, am I just being as careful there, even with somebody who's speaking of something as wild and the world being blown apart, as coming up with a conventional kind of lyrical ending? But that, it seemed, could stay that way. In a story like Shifting, which has as a conceit learning to drive a standard transmission car but also having sex, a woman has an affair with a young boy who's teaching her how to drive a car, and her husband doesn't know she's even learning this skill. I wrote the ending of that, and I really did sort of bring all the strands together. And then I just thought, oh, that's so deeply disappointing. What do you really want to do with the story? And it wasn't a profound last line that I came up with, but it was almost like I'd put a rubber stamp to it or something like that. It now ends with something like, that was in 1972 in Philadelphia. Boom. So undercutting all that lyricism, the question is, when can you let it stay? When are you just making it artificial because that's aesthetically conventional, or isn't there something that you want to say more with the subtext of the story? Isn't there maybe a surprise after the surprise?
It always still, rereading these stories, it still amazes me. I think their way of being funny is still funny. Their surprises still surprise me. I still gasp as I remember having once gasped at reversals. And I feel more than that, that in many cases, you've helped me to know people in the world. I'm still waiting for the writer to come along and help me understand what families are like today. But if I know what they were like then, it's largely because I had read your stories. Now, I think that you've been living through, as a writer, a rather extraordinary thing. You know, it wasn't until after Hemingway or Fitzgerald had died that people had decided, oh, who cares about Hemingway and Fitzgerald? And then they come back again. But you've been living through a period of relative neglect. And I wondered, because, I mean, it seems, if you'll pardon me, clear to anyone sensible that that's just part of the story of a writer's life. It's not because your stories have become less good or that they weren't always good, that part of the history of a story is that it get rejected at some time after it's been very, very popular. So people don't like the way Hemingway treated women. People are nervous about the way Fitzgerald had too much regard for money. Now, what is writing like when you've had, in a way, your hands tied behind you? Everyone reads and says, Ann Beattie, we want to read a great Ann Beattie story, but we don't want it to be an Ann Beattie story.
Well, I'm still not writing to please the audience. I'm writing to please myself. So believe me, I don't want it to be an Ann Beattie story either. You can't help but see when you put together something like the New Yorker stories that there are common themes and there are common outlooks and so forth. I mean, my sensibility is only my sensibility. But I don't think either as a writer that everything can be a clear advance forward. I really don't think that. I think that to some extent, you know, you get known as an Ann Beattie story as opposed to somebody really taking the stories on their own terms. I wonder how they would be reacted to, for better or for worse, if my name weren't associated with them.
I've been talking with Ann Beattie, one of the funniest but most melancholic writers I know of and one of my favorites. Ann is most recently the collector of her New Yorker stories, published by Scribner's. The book is The New Yorker Stories. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.